Today on Rainbow Country, the Flyer Vault, 150 years of Toronto's concert history, plus new Canadian film, Brotherhood, recounting the true 1926 story of a band of teenage boys at summer camp when a canoe trip turns into a fight for survival. And coverage of Indie Week music festival and conference with Polish indie artist Lipek. Stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio Toronto Style right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Welcome to Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country, a Mark Tara. This is episode 180. Today, my coverage of Indie Week music festival and conference continues with Polish indie artist Lipek. Plus, new Canadian film, Brotherhood, currently playing at Cineplex Yonge and Dundas in Toronto, based on true events from 1926 about a canoe trip gone wrong. And The Flyer Vault, 150 years of Toronto's concert history, from authors Daniel Tate and Rob Bowman. But up first, direct from Poland, indie artist Lipek.
Big Sunday, had to work all day. Bloody rainy Monday, she paints the summer day. And all I want is clearly the road without a bend. Wait until the morning, till the very end. No one knows where it goes. In the sunlight it seems I know. Have the chain, have the goal. You're the life and no one knows. Confused in mind, my friend. But it's too cold to wake up and take this road again. No one knows where it goes. In the sunlight it seems I know. Have the chain, have the goal. You're the life of washing out the promise You made one summer day. No one knows where it goes. In the sunlight it seems I know. Have the change, have the gold. You're the light and no one knows.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. And you?
I'm good.
That's
I'm
great.
Good.
You look
you're,
great.
You're, thank you. You're from Poland.
I'm from Poland, yes.
And you're in Toronto for Indie Week.
Yes.
How has this experience been for you?
An experience. It's my first time in Canada. So, you know, it's not only the festival, but the place, the city. I like it a lot. I mean, everyone's very friendly, and I like the vibe. I remember going to New York in winter, and it was a bit similar vibe for me, you know, that you know, the streets and the cars and the people, something like that. There is even this small Times Square here. So, and the festival. Well, I haven't played yet. I've got three shows ahead. One is tonight, the other one is after midnight, and the other one is on Saturday. So three shows, three different places.
What type of music, first of all?
Type of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was this the scene in the movie called, you know, about Elvis. And this girl asks him when he sits at Sam Phillips' office in 1954. And she says, "What do you sing?" And he says, like, "I sing everything." And she says, "Okay, but do you sing Hillbilly?" "Yeah, I sing Hillbilly." "And how do you sound like in Hillbilly?" And he says, "I don't sound like nobody, you know?" So this is this difficult word for me. It's called genre. Yeah, so I would say it's something between alt, folk, and rock.
You're a singer-songwriter?
Singer-songwriter, yes. I sing and I write songs.
Mm-hmm. Do you play guitar?
I play guitar. Not good, but I play guitar. I've got my whole band in Poland, six people. But, you know, it was too expensive to bring them here. I thought we were going to get a grant. Well, anyways, normally we play like with a big band, and I mostly sing. I play guitar, but, you know, like simple chords. And this is sort of a new experience for me that I have to, you know, like perform at the festival just with the guitar. But Cameron from the festival was kind of nice because he tells me, "Don't worry, Dylan is not a good guitarist either." So
so I take it you're doing more of an acoustic set when you're here in Toronto? You're doing more of an acoustic set?
Yeah, acoustic. Well, I'm going to use an amplifier for the guitar. Mm. It's an electric.
But it's going to be you and guitar?
Yes.
Yes.
But I thought, you know, yesterday there was this girl, I don't remember which band it was, and she was like, she had this shiny dress, and she was lying on the floor singing. So I thought, I'm going to do this tonight. Leave my guitar, you know, and just lie on the floor and sing, maybe.
Why not?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Lee Pack, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Sometimes it's cold when you're gone. Waiting that time heals it all. And I say, over and out. Sometimes it feels like time. Sometimes I wake up at night
passé. Sometimes I get a little nervous, thinking about the good times. Oh, and sometimes it feels so vague. Sometimes like dying.
Hey, this is Michelle Tracy. I'm a singer-songwriter, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
For more information on Lee Peck, check him out on socials and on Spotify. Lee Peck, L-E-E-P-E-C-K, all one word, Lee Peck. Brotherhood, a new Canadian movie currently playing in Toronto, Cineplex Yonge and Dundas, part of Canadian history, part of Ontario's history. Brotherhood tells the tragic story of a 1926 canoeing accident that happened on Balsam Lake in Ontario. Up next, writer and director of Brotherhood, Richard Bell.
My paddle's keen and bright, flashing with silver. Follow the wild goose flight, dip, dip, and swing. Dip, dip, and swing her back, flashing with silver. Follow the wild goose fly, dip, dip, and swing.
All right, boys.
This is the Brotherhood of St. Andrews.
Hello, boys.
Hello, sir.
Let's get to work, boys.
At this camp, you'll get out of it what you put in. Games, duty, devotion.
Risk builds character, Mr. Langdon.
Challenge builds character.
This is a leadership camp, not a holiday.
From this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today has shed his blood with me, shall be my brother.
Storyteller, truth seeker, filmmaker. He is writer and director Richard Bell. Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Wow, I'm loving that introduction.
It's very short.
No, it's short, cogent, sweet.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for being here in studio mm-hmm. to have your voice and your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for that.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. Let's start here. A story dating back to 1926, Balsam Lake, about 2 hours from Toronto.
Yes.
Brotherhood. You wrote this film. You directed this film. Essentially, what is this film about?
Well, Brotherhood is based on the true story of the Brotherhood of St. Andrew Anglican Group, which was out of St. James Cathedral here in Toronto. And these boys and some camp leaders assembled on the shores of Balsam Lake at Long Point for 2 weeks of a leadership camp of watercraft and kite making, marshmallow roasts, all that kind of fun stuff that mm-hmm. we can all relate to. And they set off across Balsam Lake in a 30-foot war canoe, which is a very long and slender canoe. And they were just going across the lake to Cobequunk to pick up supplies. And a summer storm descended on them. Just a summer storm kicked up from nowhere. And they got broadsided by a wave and they went tumbling into the wash. And this story is a survival story about these boys, this band of brothers, trying to survive the evening, clinging to an overturned canoe. So that's what happens in the movie. But what it's about is, I think it's a story about masculinity. It's a story about boyhood and manhood. It's very much a story about identity and coming of age, sacrifice, heroism. There's a ticking time clock. It's ultimately, it's a story about boys becoming men over the course of an evening, trying to stay alive and keep their wits. And it's very much informed by the decade preceding it. Canada, of course, was a very young country at the time. We had just come out of the Great War, which is when Canada came of age itself and joined, you know, the Brotherhood of Nations, really. The two camp counselors were both veterans of the Great War. And they approach educating and nurturing their charges, these young boys, in very different ways. So, again, a study of masculinity. A lot of the boy campers are male archetypes. So we have like the rebel, you know, kind of like the River Phoenix, the kid who smokes behind the cookhouse. We have the nerd, the wimp, the kid brother, the older brother, the brain. although it's a true story and it's based on real characters, for me, it was a study into the whole idea of masculinity and identity.
I want to talk about the look of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Moments in the film, and this is just coming from me, little gay old me,
mm-hmm.
and the little gay part of me.
Mm-hmm.
There were moments in the film where, especially focusing on the young men in their 1920s swimsuits, frolicking
right.
on the beach.
Right.
There were moments when, for me, it reminded me of Pet Shop Boys' music video for Being Boring.
Oh, wow. I love that video.
Directed by fashion photographer Bruce Weber.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, were you conscious of capturing, say, young men's sensuality when it came to those scenes? Was that something that you were conscious of?
Oh, yeah. I was definitely conscious of it. I think any story or movie that kind of involves a bunch of guys who are good looking, who are palling around, and, you know, as I mentioned, the camaraderie and all that kind of stuff is going to smack of a certain homoeroticism. And so I knew that I wouldn't say that I wrote any homoerotica into the movie, because I just knew that it was just going to happen, right? Like there was going to be some kind of like a bit of, you know, Abercrombie.
Your horse playing.
Yeah, there's going to be a certain amount of Abercrombie and Fitchness to you know, the camaraderie.
So it wasn't just me.
No, it wasn't just you. The thing that was interesting, though, was that I had people who read the script who kind of like were who were discouraging me from having moments like that, who would say things like, oh, that's going to be a bit gay, or, you know, people are going to think the director.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, yeah, exactly. To be honest with you, I actually thought the movie was going to turn out more homoerotic than it did.
Do tell.
Well, I think that's probably because of the actors. I'm pretty sure that all the actors are straight. And I think that just the choices that they made were kind of informed by heterosexual actors. So it was just kind of interesting. So I get more of kind of like a hockey team kind of feel, camaraderie to their joshing and razzing, than I do like a Herb Ritzian kind of homoerotic, you know. But I don't mind that people see that. Like it's there.
I guess we all see it through our own individual lenses.
And for me, like the pleasure now as this movie goes out into the world is seeing the movie through other people's eyes. But as it goes out into the world and people share with me the images that capture their imagination, and when I hear something from their point of view, it's like seeing the movie again or seeing it for the first time. There's this story I remember about this English professor who said, "I wish I could read Romeo and Juliet for the very first time." And for me, it's like, I wish I could read or I could see Brotherhood for the very first time. The closest I can come to that is when I talk to someone like you who says, you know, because I kind of forgot about that, like, but it's there. And so that's a real gift for me.
So what's the plan with Brotherhood? Is it going to be hitting streaming services? What's going to happen?
Well, Brotherhood, so if you're in Toronto, Brotherhood, there's 4 screenings a day, every day for sure until December 12th. And it's showing at Cineplex Young Dundas, which is fantastic. I'm so happy and so proud to have a movie that's at the Cineplex and, you know, in the heart of Toronto. And it's totally meaningful because, you know, the boys, the leadership group was out of St. James Cathedral, which is, you know, a kilometer away from Young Dundas. They're buried at St. James Cemetery on Parliament Street, which is 2.5 kilometers from Young Dundas. Yes, I looked it all up. I really hope that audiences go and see it on the big screen. I think the modern reality is more people will see it on streaming and on iTunes. But I got to tell you, like every filmmaker, we want you to go to the theater. We want you to see it on the big screen. We want you to hear it in that Dolby 7.1 or 5.1. So it's going to show in Toronto for the next week for sure. And then it opens at a independent theater in Sudbury on December 13th. And I believe it runs for a week there.
Well said. Ooh. Richard Bell, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
My paddle's keen and bright, flashing with silver. Follow the wild goose flight, dip, dip, and swing. Dip, dip, and swing her back, flashing with silver. Follow the wild goose fly, dip, dip, and swing.
All right, boys.
This is the Brotherhood of St. Andrew.
Hello, boys.
Hello, sir.
Let's get to work, boys.
At this camp, you'll get out of it what you put in. Games, duty, devotion.
Risk builds character, Mr. Langdon.
Challenge builds character.
This is a leadership camp, not a holiday.
This day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today has shed his blood with me, shall be my brother.
My name is Charles Officer, and I'm the writer and director of Invisible Essence, The Little Prince. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Canadian history, part of Ontario's history. Brotherhood, currently playing at Cineplex Yonge and Dundas in Toronto. Speaking of history, 150 years of Toronto's concert history. Up next, the Flyer Vault. The number one best-selling book on Amazon.ca under the music history category, 5-star ratings across the board, the book, The Flyer Vault, 150 years of Toronto concert history. Joining me in studio, the authors of The Flyer Vault, Daniel Tate and Rob Bowman. Hi.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
How are you?
Doing well. Yourself?
Life is beautiful. Every day in every way.
So, first of all, before we get started, I want to say this to you. Thank you for taking your time to be here with me to have your story be heard by Toronto's LGBT community and beyond. So, thank you so much for that.
You're welcome, but thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
Seriously. We're glad to speak to every community.
Absolutely. So, Daniel Tate, you guys have a number one book on your hands. In a nutshell, Daniel Tate, what is your book about, essentially?
In a nutshell, our book is about the glorious history of live music in our city, going back a century and a half, all the way back to 1840, in fact, and just taking a look back and taking a retrospective of just all the cool acts, musical artists that have played in stages all over the city, across different genres, different communities, and we really deep dive into that history, and it's a gift for the city. Rob, anything you'd like to add to that?
I think you pretty well summed it up. It's a fascinating, amazing, awe-inspiring, and always surprising history of just how vital this city has been, literally since 1840. I don't think we could have gone further back, but that's further than we plan to.
So, Daniel Tate, this book came about because of essentially because of the popularity of your Instagram postings. I'm interested to know what inspired the idea to go from a digital posting to a physical book, from going from digital to physical. What sparked that idea?
It actually went from, just to go back, it went from physical to digital back to physical, which makes it pretty interesting, 'cause really these flyers are analog artifacts, tangible items you would hold in your hand to hear about the next party that was going on. And I then started scanning them, uploaded them to Instagram, turning it into a digital art project essentially. But then realized that Instagram didn't really do justice to the stories that were kind of imprinted in all these flyers. And there was there's so much to tell. There's so many long form stories that I wanted to come out. And Instagram just wasn't the appropriate outlet for that, because Instagram's a very short attention span type of platform. So we decided, me and Rob decided both, that a book would make sense. So we brought it back to the physical world.
I also see what we do as potentially multi-platform. I mean, you started your Instagram account, and I was building a database of great shows in this city separately before we even knew each other. But once we got together, we started talking about the possibility of exhibits, then the possibility of a book. It turned out the book came before exhibits came. At one point, we nearly had an exhibit. And who knows where it will go from here. But it starts with Daniel being smart enough to keep several thousand flyers that he had helped put up on streets and that other people were doing street promotion for other promoters. Daniel kept it all and then decided he wanted to reach further back. So it's, analog to digital to analog, but I see it as, again, potentially very, very multi-platform. We might eventually do just simply an internet site which has thousands of posters and let it be interactive with various audience members posting their stories.
So, Rob Bowman, how did you originally meet Daniel Tate?
Well, I got a cold email. You used to call them cold calls, but I will call it a cold email. Daniel was looking – he was really fascinated with Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton's group. Mm-hmm. And I'd done 3 CDs with P-Funk. And somebody told Daniel that, and when Daniel was looking for flyers for when P-Funk used to live here and played a lot at Hawk's Nest and Le Coq d'Or, somebody told Daniel, well, if anyone's going to have the stuff, Rob Bowman's going to have it. I didn't. But he reached out to me to see if I did, and I said, no, I didn't, and he told me what he's up to, and I can't remember who said, let's have coffee, but we did. Met each other. He opened up his laptop. I saw all these incredible images. And as I mentioned earlier, I had separately, I'd kept a list of every show I've seen since I was 12. And I'd seen an astonishing number of shows. Literally handwritten list and eventually putting in my computer. And then I began to think what was going on here before I was of age. And so I started asking older people and started doing a little research. Then I wrote a history book. I'm a university professor of music. I wrote a history book of popular music in Canada. And so I was looking at how Canada reacted to rock and roll in the 50s. And so I researched all the 50s stuff. And that got me interested in going a little bit further. So it was kind of piecemeal. But I'd started building this long database and told Daniel about it. I'm seeing Daniel's stuff, and immediately we realized we were kindred spirits. We're very different generations, and our musical tastes overlap, but they're not exactly the same. But we both are wide open-minded. I mean, Daniel was curious to know about early jazz and blues and stuff even before that, and gospel and so on, stuff long before my time, but I'd researched and knew about. And Daniel knows all sorts of things about electronica. I know a fair bit, but he certainly knows more, was at more events. And so we shared our knowledge and shared our curiosity and just went for it.
This whole project was like entering a time machine. It was literally like opening up the DeLorean, dialing it back to 1934, whatever year I wanted to go to.
Or 1861.
Or 1861. And just imagining what it was like to, say, be a jazz hipster in this city, you know, late 30s, going to see Chick Webb or Fletcher Henderson. Like, you know, amazing stuff. And then I'd listen to all this music, and it was just mind-blowing.
It was one rabbit hole after another.
I want to talk about some of the flyers, but I want to talk about one particular flyer that's in the book. And I was very upset at the two of you for putting this in the book.
Uh-oh.
And
what do we do?
You're about to find out.
All right.
It's on page 280 of the Flyer Vault.
I don't know.
And when I saw this, I was like, God damn it. I got upset because I wasn't around for this. But it's from CPI Presents Live and More, Donna Summer, at Maple Leaf Gardens. And I live by Maple Leaf Gardens now. And this is the poster.
Yeah.
It's a great poster. She looks wonderful. She looks resplendent.
So first of all, do you remember how you got this? Was this a flyer or from a newspaper?
Yeah, so that was from the newspaper. Again, just digging through old editions of the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, looking in the entertainment sections. But for that one, I was on the hunt for Donna Summer. I was.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And, okay. And I knew she toured off the strength of I Need Love. And I wanted to know when she was here. And I found out the date, but I couldn't really find any sort of visual artifacts of that show. So then I started to get to work on the newspaper archives. And lo and behold, that wonderful ad, showed itself. And yeah. I was like, that's worthy for the book.
You wouldn't believe the detail to find these things. And often what would happen is I'd go, did Sylvester ever play here? Like when we're, writing the disco dance part of it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, let's find out. And we dig. Turns out I don't think he ever did. But Donna Summer, we certainly found. Of course she played here.
Yeah.
And so when Daniel wrote that particular chapter, of course that was an important thing to include. Donna Summer was huge and super, super important.
And apparently they converted Maple Leaf Gardens into a discotheque. There was like this massive massive disco ball.
For the show.
And for the show. And it must have been an incredible show. Unfortunately, I wasn't alive when it happened.
So, Daniel Tate, would you say it was maybe being a raver in the 90s or maybe being part of a hip-hop concert promotions company? Which one was more important for you when it comes to gathering your flyers, being a raver or being part of the hip-hop concert community?
It's all part of the same package. It's all together. It's all bundled up equally as good. I love hip hop. I love house. I love dance music. I love rock and roll. I love it all. But I think with the electronic music chapter, being like a house music fanatic, I definitely started looking back to how house music, came to be. And obviously you have to look at the disco era and even before disco, a lot of the disco soul and funk guys that were coming out in the early 70s. So just continuing to go back from where it all came from and having Rob to help kind of steer that path was very helpful.
And you know what's super cool? The whole house phenomena led people to rediscover disco and in some ways to re-envision what disco was.
Yeah.
'Cause for you know, there was that horrible, ridiculous reaction of disco sucks by a lot of people at the time. And I think a lot of it was homophobic, a lot of it was racist, a lot of it was misogynist. And it's so great that house music ended up, if you will, recovering the history of disco and framing it differently for current and future generations.
Yeah. What's that? Talk to me about Geddy Lee doing the foreword for the book, like lead singer of iconic rock group Rush. How did that happen?
I'm still pinching myself. I don't know how it happened.
Well,
how
it
did that happen? Because
I know.
Is this
how
a
it
dream?
Happened.
I feel like I'm still in a dream. You know what? It happened because he somehow – well, I was posting a lot of Rush stuff on the Flyer Vault Instagram account. Mm-hmm. And so he got wind of it. I guess he saw one of the Rush flyers that I'd posted.
It was the Massey Hall 76, he said.
I think it was – yeah, it was the 2112 tour or that show. And I just saw my feed, Geddy Lee is following you. I was like – like the Geddy Lee? Maybe there's like an imposter or something. Maybe it's just some like random dude named Geddy Lee, but not really Geddy Lee. But he had the blue check mark, so it was really Geddy Lee. And I was blown away by that, and that really gave me extra energy to double down on this project and really try to put out some really good historical content. And I certainly posted more Rush stuff and Cream stuff and Rockpile stuff because I knew he was one of my followers. And just on a whim, I DM'd him one day and I said, hey, me and Rob Bowman are working on this book. Do you want to get involved? I know you love Toronto. You love music, of course. Mm-hmm. It took a little bit of time and some patience, but he eventually agreed.
It's amazing.
Amazing.
Daniel Tate, your work chronicling Toronto's live music history has been featured in The Globe and Mail, Now Magazine, Vice, Blog TO.
Toronto Star,
thank you.
CBC News.
CP24.
All in the last week, those ones.
How would you say Toronto's music scene in 2019 and 2020 compares to, say, yesteryear?
That's a common question. We still have a vibrant music scene. We still have an underground music scene. We have different, stages all over the city. There's still a good amount of venues. A lot of venues have closed down, and that is sad. But I still feel that there's a strong appetite for live music in this city. And I think also there's a lot of DIY spaces that are sort of an answer to a lot of traditional spaces that have been closing down. And that can also make things fairly dynamic as well. So overall, I think change is inevitable. It's not like I look back in time and kind of sigh and like, oh, I wish it was like then. I don't think that way. I just think that we've evolved. People will always love live music, whether performing it or experiencing it. And I don't really think the internet is going to really kill that. It'll change it. It'll influence it. Yeah. But I think humanity's need for live music will always be there in some shape, form, or fashion.
I think the thing that's influenced what happens now has a lot to do with capitalism and gentrification and the price of what it costs to do anything in the city. And it's forced a lot of clubs to close because the rents simply become insane or the land gets sold from under them and becomes condos. So I think, unfortunately, up-and-coming bands have a harder time. But international touring bands always are going to come here. There's spaces for them to play, and it just means the ticket price gets, you know, X higher. Mm-hmm. But they're always going to come here because Toronto's the gateway to Canada. It's got 10 million people within a two-hour drive. So if you're a European band or an Asian band, you're going to do three gigs in North America, New York, Toronto, L.A. Mm-hmm. We are so unbelievably fortunate in this amazing city.
Well said, Rob Bowman.
That's too well said. Thank you, Mark.
On that note, let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill. But without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former cabinet minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
So, Rob Bowman, you are a professor of ethnomusicology. You are a music writer and a Grammy winner. First of all, how did you get into music and your love of music in the first place?
Well, that's an easy one. 7 years old. My brother's 7 years older than me. He has a new girlfriend who's just moved here from England about 5 months before the Beatles played Ed Sullivan. She's brought Beatle records with her. And she's telling us about this phenomenon of Beatlemania. And she brings over some singles to our house. And God knows why my 14-year-old brother let a 7-year-old sibling hang out with him, but he did. I remember this girl, Rosemary Goodrum. I love her to death. And I love my brother to death, too. And she put on the single of Please Please Me. And I also heard she brought up Twist and Shout. And on both of them, I heard John Lennon's voice. And it suddenly made me feel alive in a way. Not that I'd felt dead before. My life was okay, you know, like any other 7-year-old. Life's okay, you know, everything's good. But suddenly it was so much brighter. It was infinitely more exciting. I had a reason to get up every morning because there were Beatle records to hear. That literally started it when I was 7. That set the path that takes me right up to this moment sitting here with you.
Daniel Tate, do you have a musical background?
Like in terms of playing an instrument?
Yeah, or... you know, studied music or anything?
Not really. I mean, I played the recorder in grade 5, 6, and 7.
Well, I won tapes.
And then in grade 8, I played the baritone.
So I've scratched a
couple pieces of wax on a turntable here and there, but that's about the extent of it.
Rob, do you have a music background?
Absolutely. I play trombone, euphonium. I hack on piano and guitar. I play cello, viola, the gamba. I used to sing in rock bands. I wouldn't be a professor of music if I didn't.
Okay.
You know, I did a BA in music, an MA in music, and a PhD in music.
Ethnomusicology, what does that mean?
It's a terrible word. And I, you know, in some ways I hate the word, but it's been around since the 1880s when it started. And that is the term that people use. Ethnomusicology is a way of approaching the study of music. So it's not just sound unto itself. It's not just about chord progressions and voicings. It is about that too, but it's also, and even more importantly, about music as cultural behavior. What is this group of people? Listen to this moment, music at this moment in time. What is it about those sounds? What is it about all the stuff that goes with that sound? What is it about kinetic culture, meaning dance and movement? What's it about sartorial culture, hair, clothes, iconography? What is the whole thing and how is social meaning brought about? And of course, it does start with the sound. We never ignore the sound. But the old way of doing musicology, reading scores by Mozart and, you know, to me, it's just the beginning. I think you could take an ethnomusicological approach to Mozart or to Richie Houghton or Donna Summer.
1995.
Yeah.
Best album notes, Grammys. The Grammys. The Grammys, Rob Bowman. You won the 1995 Grammy for Best Album Notes, the Complete Stax Vault. Soul Singles, Volume 3, 1972 to 1975. Let's geek out just a bit.
That's a mouthful.
Okay, did you get your Grammy on TV?
No. Unfortunately, the album note or liner note category, or you know, I've also been nominated as a producer in the historic reissue category.
6 nominations for you in total.
Total, yeah. They're not sexy enough to be on TV. It's not like R&B Song of the Year or, you know. whatever.
Damn them.
Yeah, I agree. That category is never on TV, but you know, it's always one of the things where they go, and earlier tonight, you know, and they quickly show about seven awards and you get seven stills of people accepting their award. It's the pre-ceremony. It's still a massively big thing if you do work in the field that I do work in. It was pretty surreal.
Okay. So let's geek out.
Okay.
They call your name and the Grammy goes to, the winner is Rob Bowman. What goes through your mind?
You're giving me chills because I'm reliving it right now.
Good.
Literally, literally. It was my third nomination.
Okay.
I'd lost the first two. Now, you know, being nominated is a big deal. And it's, you know, first time you're going there, you're just like, you want to win. You want to win. You want to win so badly. And maybe your award's 45 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes into the ceremony. And you're waiting and you're waiting and time is passing so slowly. It's like, come on, get to my award. And then it's finally, it's coming to your award. And the nominees are, and they read the five names and the projects. And the envelope, the winner is, and you're like, and then you hear somebody else's name and your eyes shut and you sort of fall back in your seat. And it's like, oh, such a letdown. You know, it's cool to be nominated. Everybody says, oh, it's just amazing to be nominated. But you know, that's what it is. So I've been through that twice. Third time I was nominated. This is kind of funny. First two times I thought I had a shot at winning.
Okay.
I was wrong. And the third time, I didn't even think I'd be nominated. Mm. Partially because it was a sequel. It was the third in a trilogy of box sets reissuing stacked soul singles. As you said, it was volume three. Volume one got two nominations.
Okay.
Volume two was ignored. And volume two is better than volume one. I know it is. But I thought, okay, sequelitis, they ignore it. So volume three, I thought, no one's going to pay attention to this in terms of the Grammys. I get a phone call one afternoon, and it's this woman who works for the record company. And she says, congratulations. And I said to her, on what? And she goes, you got nominated for a Grammy. And I'd done several projects, as I do most years. So I said, for which project? I had no clue. I wasn't even thinking about it. So she tells me, so, okay, cool. I wasn't even going to go. I had two little kids. I was basically a single parent. And I thought, eh, it's just indulgent for me to go and lose again. I've been through this experience. This is no chance of winning. Mavis Staples, who's a Staples singer, is a really good friend of mine. Mavis was going to host the R&B Pioneer Awards the next night, also in L.A. Mavis assumed I was going to the Grammy, so she phoned me up and goes, so blah, 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 you know, come with me to the R&B Pioneer. And that was too irresistible. I adore Mavis, and those awards are incredible in terms of what musicians play and so on. So I thought, okay, what the heck? I'll go to the Grammys, you know. I'll lose again and blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, this time the evening's just flying by. I'm not worried about a thing. I have no chance of winning. I'm not nervous. The other times I had speeches prepared in my mind. This time I had nothing. So it comes to blah, blah, blah. And the nominees are blah. And then, and the winner is, and I just hear Rob, as in the first part of Rob. And my eyes dilate. I have my shoulder bag with me. I give it to my friend and I say, hold this. And I get up. And it's like the silly things in a movie, Mark. It's like when everything goes into slow motion, the two lovers are running at the train station to meet each other, or the Olympic athletes slowly going across the finish line. Everything went into slow motion. I couldn't hear a thing. I didn't notice I didn't hear a thing, but I know that later because I have videotape of it. And there's people, a couple of people scream when my name's announced. Must be friends of mine. But I didn't hear that at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm walking towards the stage, and I'm thinking, don't trip. And then I'm thinking, what are you going to say? Now, I'm pretty quick on my feet. So I quickly had my thing together. And I got up there, and I remember being given the Grammy by Chris Isaac. And the thing's really heavy. And I never thought about, what does a Grammy weigh? So he puts it in my hands, and I go, oh, now I know why everybody always puts these things down. Okay. They are heavy. So I put it down, and then I did my speech, and it went really well. And it was surreal. Then you go backstage, and you know, you do photo shoots. You, at that point, you know, it was new, but you were doing internet interviews. Mm-hmm. Then you do press interviews with all, you know, probably 80 reporters firing questions at you. I think I did radio interviews. I can't remember, but you're about 45, 50 minutes doing media. And finally, you get back out to join whoever you came with and spend the rest of the evening. And when you go to the after party as a loser, It's fine. As a winner, it's insane.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How?
People coming up to you don't even know. Okay. People you've adored your whole life. Mm-hmm. Other, you know, musicians and so on, saying they loved your speech or congratulations. It's just a high beyond belief.
So when was that ceremony? Was that earlier in the evening?
The ceremony is literally right before. It's about a 2.5-3 hour ceremony. Mm-hmm. Then there's about a half hour, 40-minute break, and then the TV ceremony.
Okay.
With all the big awards. And okay, when I came back here, it's interesting. I never thought about this. Canadians treat you as if you won it for the country. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you're an Olympic athlete. Mm-hmm. I don't think they do that in the States. Maybe they do it regionally. You know, if you win in Cincinnati, everybody lives in Cincinnati, thinks you won it for the mm-hmm. city or something. But I had people stop me in the grocery store and go, congratulations, thank you so much. So I'm like, you know, the prime minister was calling me, literally.
Wow. It
was pretty funny. I never even thought about any of that. I had people who found me, of course, you know, the internet existed and email existed by then, but I had people who found me who I'd gone to school with in kindergarten and grade two, mm-hmm. who I hadn't talked to since then, reaching out. It was for a few months, day in, day out, inundated with people afterwards. It was a pretty heady experience.
So after your win, did your life change? Did your music career change at all?
You know what? Even a nomination will change a little bit. You get more phone calls, now more emails, but you get more people wanting to work with you. You get your price goes up. I mean, it does help. But when you say, did my life change? My career, you know, it was a boost. But my life has always been about music, mm-hmm. and it's always been about working intensely with as much purity as I can about music, and that didn't change. It's been that way from the word go, and that just continues. It continues to this day. Just finished a set of liner notes literally this afternoon.
So where do you keep your Grammy?
I have an old phonograph machine, believe it or not, a wind-up phonograph. Mm-hmm. So the Grammy sits on the gramophone.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Fitting.
Yeah.
So you're a writer. You're a professor. Did you, growing up, think that you would be a Grammy winner?
You know, I can't
Did
say
you think that would be in your future?
When I grew up, I knew my life was going to be music. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe I was going to be a rock and roll star.
Okay.
That didn't happen. And I began, you know, at a certain age, you begin to realize that isn't going to happen. I might have made a living playing music, but I was never going to change the world as a musician. I was never going to be touring and playing, you know, big theaters or arenas and so on. It would be playing bars and eking out a living in not such a fun environment. I would get old pretty soon. Mm-hmm. But when I was 18, I found out about ethnomusicology my first day at university doing my undergraduate. I had an amazing professor. It's 4 o'clock Monday afternoon. I could take you to the room and show you the seat I was in. He blew my mind because he could talk about Howlin' Wolf, this great Chicago bluesman, Ornette Coleman, one of my favorite jazz players, and the music of the Pygmies that I cheery rainforest and connect them all. I thought, how can this guy be so hip? What is he all about? Hmm. And he was an ethnomusicologist. And over the next few years, I began to think maybe an MA in ethnomusicology would be an interesting adventure. And then more and more, I began to think, I'm studying jazz. I'm studying classical music. I'm studying some world music. Why am I not studying funk, soul, rock and roll, the music that are most important to me? Why are those not at university? So I decided part of my mission was I was going to be the first person in this country to teach about those musics at university. Mm. And you know what? That's what I became.
Wow.
I offered the very first course ever in rock and roll in Canada. I offered the very first course ever in rhythm and blues, including soul, funk, and hip-hop in
Trailblazer.
Canada. Absolutely.
Pioneer. Fantastic.
Chutzpah. drive. And nearly a refusal to take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. Just figure, okay, if this door's closed, what door can I open? How can I get there? How can I do it?
On that note, let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 895 FM, discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do. globally and right here in Toronto and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
Hey, this is Michelle Tracy. I'm a singer-songwriter, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Daniel Tate, why collecting flyers? Why collecting flyers, posters? Why that?
Because they were meaningful to me because they had pictures of my musical heroes.
And you just naturally gravitated to that?
When I was coming up in the 90s, the only way you could really find out about what was going on and where the hot party was at was getting a flyer, right? So there was this tangible piece of information that was often just a beautiful design, very extravagant, sophisticated art, because you want to grab people's eyes and have it pop to let them know that your party's the hot party, right? So going to raves in the mid-90s when I first started, you know, the flyers started getting bigger and bigger and more sophisticated. And that was basically telling you, this is the party you got to go to because, you know, everybody was competing. But because I love music so much, I just felt a kinship to these little pieces of paper, and I decided to keep them. And then when I ended up getting a job working in the concert industry, that love continued. So I just kind of hoarded all these flyers. And I'm not a hoarder by nature, but when it came to these pieces and just anything music related in general, I tend to hold on to.
And Daniel gets big kudos for doing that because he's really preserving history. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been into history for a long time, writing about, researching, interviewing people. But Daniel, fortunately, was preserving these pieces of material culture that a lot of them are visually say so much about the day, the period, the style of music. It's, I think it's done a service to our community at large.
Yeah, yeah. You were most recently nominated for a Grammy in, 2018, 2019 for the Jackie Shane Project?
Yes.
Any Other Way?
Yeah, that's right.
What was that like for you?
You know what? It was.
She recently passed away.
She passed away 9 days after the Grammys. And it breaks my heart. Jackie and I became quite close. And in fact, I'd called her right after we lost at the pre-ceremony before it would be on TV. So she had, you know, I was the first to tell her that. And that was on a Sunday, I believe. On Tuesday, I tried calling her and she didn't answer. Jackie always answers. Jackie doesn't go out. She goes out once a month or went out once a month shopping and banking. But basically, Jackie didn't go anywhere. She always answered her phone. No answer Tuesday. No answer Tuesday night, no answer Wednesday. I started getting really worried. I called a mutual friend in Nashville, one of the very, very few people who she allowed to see her and enter her house. And Lorenzo, I said, have you talked to Jackie? And he goes, no, but I was going to call her today. I said, I'm really worried, blah, blah, blah. So he went over to her house. He had a key to the apartment. He's the only one who did. And unfortunately found that she had passed away. The project itself was a dream come true for me. I started writing about music when I was 15. I got my first gig writing for magazines. That was in 1971, November. Jackie left the city in December. Now, I had her records. I knew about Jackie. I knew how great she was.
And but Jackie, back in the 60s, was, you know, from originally from America.
Yeah, originally from Nashville.
And a black singer. Today, we would be considered transgender.
Right, and that's what Jackie considered herself. But at the time, people saw Jackie as an effeminate male, and people more in the know understood Jackie was gay. But even gay men that I've talked to from back then, and gay women for that matter, never thought about the word transgender. I don't even know how many people would even conceive of the notion. But Jackie knew. Jackie told me that when she was 13, she told her mother, Mom, I'm a woman in a man's body.
Wow.
And you know what her mother said? This is Nashville in 1953. Her mother was so hip. Her mother said, that's fine. And then her mother, a few weeks later, took her, I can't remember if it was a carnival or a circus, took her to, you know, the freak show where the one-armed man is and the woman with the beard and all this stuff. And she goes, Jackie, see these people? See that guy with the one arm? See this person? See that person? They're all God's creatures. She's a religious woman. They're all God's creatures. They're all wonderful creations. They're all beautiful. And so are you. And don't you ever let anyone tell you otherwise. What an amazing mother for the South in 1953. This woman was decades ahead of her time. And Jackie loved her mother so dearly till the day her mother died. And that's one of the reasons she left Toronto when she did in December 71 was to be with her mother who was getting on.
Why do you think...
Oh, I didn't finish. Sorry. So when I started writing, Jackie left the city a month later. I didn't see her because you had to be 21 to get into bars then. And, you know, I'm 15. Although she did play a few all ages show I found out since then on afternoons, but I didn't hear about them. Anyway, I thought I'd love to interview this person. So when she comes back to Toronto, we'll see what I can get. Mm-hmm. She never came back. She disappeared. In fact, went into hiding for years and years and years. So it was always in the back of my mind, what happened? And I'd love to tell this person's story. And when I got a call, which was in 2016 in the fall or 2017, I think 2016, from a Numeral record saying they had actually signed Jackie Shane and we're going to be reissuing all of her material. Would I like to interview her and do the notes? I'm like, are you kidding me? I've been thinking about this since I was a kid. And it's a long story about how the whole everything got put together. But Jackie and I bonded over gospel music. She loves black gospel, and I have encyclopedic knowledge of it. Mm-hmm. And we eventually became exceedingly good friends. She talked to me for hours and hours and hours.
Why do you think she pulled away from Toronto, the music scene? What, I mean, she moved back to home for her mom. But why do you think she pulled away from the music?
You know, Jackie, there's a couple things that went on. Jackie was treated really well in Toronto. She always said that, you know, you can't pick where you're born, but you can pick where you think is home. And Toronto, for her, she always thought of as home. She was treated better here than anywhere else in her life. Mm-hmm. She lived for a while in Montreal, Boston, grew up in Nashville, moved to L.A. where her mother was, and ended up back in Nashville. Toronto was it for her. So it was never about leaving Toronto. But she was working with a guy named Frank Motley. He was a trumpeter from North Carolina. His shtick was he played two trumpets at once. And he'd been the band leader. Jackie had actually first hooked up with him back in Montreal back in the late 50s. And he was the guy she'd first come to Toronto with in the 60s. Motley was an alcoholic and he could be abusive. Once threw an ashtray at her head. Jackie warned him if she ever did that again, she had ways of dealing with such things. She was a strong person, a very strong woman. But long story short, she was in L.A., came back to work with Motley for a few months because he wasn't doing so well, needed her star power, if you will. So she agreed she'd do it for a few months, but that was it. Then she was going back to L.A. When it came to the end of what she saw as her tenure, he was refusing to pay her what he owed her as a way of trying to keep her here, keep her working for him, in effect. And they were playing a place around Yonge and Eglinton when push came to shove. She told me the only time in her life she took the subway, because she always had a driver. She never drove herself, always had a driver. She took the subway back to her apartment, which was around Girard and Yonge, and she went in to get her gun. She was going to go back and deal with Frank. And then she thought, I don't need to spend a life behind bars. So she got her lover and decided, we're leaving, we're going to L.A. She had enough of the bullshit of the music industry, not getting paid, people like Motley holding things over her. And I think when she left, I don't think she knew it was the end. I don't think she knew she was never going to perform again. But she certainly wanted to get away from Motley and wanted to leave behind the music industry for a while. Mm-hmm. And the more she stayed in L.A. with her mother, the more she did realize she didn't need this and didn't want to deal with it anymore. And that was that. It became this mystery until 2016.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's an incredible story. And she was an amazing person. I'm glad she lived to see the Grammy nomination. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, there's a lot of plans. There's plans to do a book. There's plans to do movies. And she was tentative at first, but more and more she wanted this stuff. She talked about performing. I don't know whether it ever would have happened, but she talked about performing again. Would have been amazing.
Wow, powerful. Rob Bowman. So, Daniel Tate, how can people find out more about you, more about the Flyer Vault, all that sort of stuff?
Well, we're out there now. I mean, you can do a simple Google search. There's several articles and clippings about me and Rob in this
podcasts.
Project. Podcasts, of course. Instagram, Facebook, pretty much every platform of choice. We're there.
And Rob Bowman, how can people find out all about Rob Bowman?
They'd have to hang out with me for a long time. But, you know, like Daniel, I mean, the internet's a funny world, right? Because there are tons of stuff out there if you Google me. I've won Grammys, been nominated for my books in the Blues Hall of Fame, built the Stax Museum. I've done a lot. I'm old. I've been around a long time. I've had a chance to do a lot. But I'm very, very much out there and, you know, easy to find out about me if you want to. And there's lots I'm happy to talk to anybody about.
Daniel Tate, Rob Bowman, thanks for your time and thanks for this great book.
Mark, thank you so much for having us as guests.
Thank you for having us.
Here you come again, and you say that you're my friend, but I don't know why you're here. She wants to know how I feel. Tell her that I'm any other way. People have been talking since we've been apart, and when I pass I hear them whisper, there he goes with a broken heart. But when you see my baby, here's what you say. Tell her I wouldn't have it any other way. That's all I got to say, my friend. You'd better say goodbye. I think you'd better go right now, or you might see me cry. But when you see my baby, this is what you say. Tell her I wouldn't have it any other way.
Bonsoir, Toronto. I'm recording artist Terus. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Flyer Vault, available wherever you get your favorite books. And if I may say, would make a great Christmas present, especially for a music fan. Special thanks to indie artist Lee Peck, filmmaker Richard Bell, and authors Daniel Tate and Rob Bowman for being part of episode 180. Don't forget to keep up to date with all things country, Rainbow Country. Follow me on socials. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, at Mark Tara Music. The podcast for Rainbow Country is on iTunes, podomatic.com, Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio, and on Spotify. And last week, we were number 5 on Podomatic's Gay and Lesbian chart. So get Rainbow Country wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Plus, the official Rainbow Country playlist showcasing LGBT and indie artists featured on the show is now available on Spotify. Just search Rainbow Country Playlist. And of course, everything is hooked up at my website, marktara.com. Next week, gay and black. Finally, I want to take this time to thank you for taking your time to be with me. Remember, we live in days of making dreams come true. So believe in yourself, and the world will believe in you.
Hi, I'm Mayor John Tory, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.